So today, it says in our little outline some preaching strategies and tactics. What I was going to do is try to summarize a lot of arguments. We'll start today and probably go into tomorrow. And try to pull together a lot of the different arguments that we've had and a few more. But I wanted to start off with something a little, that's tactics, but strategy is a little more overall development. So if we have a strategy, we have to know what our mission is. And I think our mission has been defined in Srila Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra, that to preach the message of Lord Chaitanya and to destroy Nirvishesha and Shunyavada philosophies. It's interesting that Prabhupada put that. It's there in his Pranam Mantra as his major mission. He's preaching the message of Lord Chaitanya in the Western countries, which are full of Nirvishesha and Shunyavada. So that's why this topic about dealing with Mayavada philosophy is so crucial, because it's part of our central a central mission in reestablishing establishing 10,000 years of a golden age of Krishna consciousness. That won't be done unless Mayavada philosophy bites the dust. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, particularly, made it his mission to deal with it also. We saw earlier how there was a Vedic restoration, Buddha, Shankaracharya, and then really Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There were the other Vaishnava Acharyas, with their mission of defeating the Mayavada philosophy. But then ultimately, it was defeated by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he took on the biggest Mayavadis of his day. We studied Prakasananda Saraswati, the leader of the Mayavadis at the Mayavadi headquarters, and another one was Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He also followed Shankaracharya, although he was a teacher and a professor of Nyaya, of logic, in another great center of learning, which was Navadvipa. That was like the Oxford and Cambridge of India, and especially noted for this Nyaya philosophy. It was called Navanyaya. In the history of Indian philosophy, if you study Nyaya, thank you, there is this Navanyaya, the new logic, which came up about the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is one of the great exponents of the Navanyaya. You can get his books in Sanskrit in the University of Pennsylvania Library. He's famous. He's a big man.
Who was it?
Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that's what I'm talking about. So he was also converted by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya took on the biggest Mayavadis of his day and defeated them and converted them. There's no evidence, by the way, that Prakashananda Saraswati ever became a Vaishnava. But in his later writings after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there's some very strange admissions for a Mayavadi, that the Lord has energies and things like that, which you don't see. The influence is there on him. So, anyway, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu set the standard. So that's really our mission now, is to defeat Mayavada philosophy everywhere. It's a central part of our mission. And I have two newspaper articles here which just kind of show two different sides of things. Here we see in India, of course, there's been a head-on confrontation with Mayavada philosophy. This is on February 3rd, Advaita's challenge to Dvaita. So the Madhva Mat in India offered 1 lakh rupees prize to anyone who could how do they put it? Who proved that Shankaracharya's Advaita as valid That's what they did. If anyone, they set up a challenge, we'll give 1 lakh of rupees to anyone who can come here and prove to us that the Advaita philosophy of Shankaracharya is valid. So this is about a response from the Shankaracharya Bhagavat Pad, one of the Shankaracharyas, that he would pay. He said, if anyone could prove Shankaracharya,
this group,
the Mayavadis, the present Shankaracharya, said if anyone could approve Shankaracharya Bhagavat Pad, that's Sripad Shankaracharya, he would pay 2 lakhs of rupees.
If anyone could disprove
him? Yeah. So the Madhva said anyone can prove him, we'll give 1 lakh. So they're saying anyone disproves him, we'll give 2 lakhs. In other words, who's the burden of proof on? That's what they're arguing about now. So anyway, this debate has been going on between the Madhvites and the Shankaracharya, like formal debates, meetings, you know, for a few thousand years. You know, since the time of Shankaracharya. It's 1,000 years anyway. It's been going on for 1,000 years off in India, where, you know, that they're really getting down to the techniques and things. But, you know, meanwhile, Krishna, you know, nobody. The trouble with these debates is no one admits they're defeated, you know. They get very, very technical, and somehow or other, these Madhva people have not managed to make anyone else a devotee of Krishna. They've stayed in India, you know. This movement is the one that spread all over the world. And our business isn't just to engage in these kind of, you know, technical debates with people like in this way, anyway. Then we see here in ISKCON World Review, there's a commentary here in the editorial page about a letter to Catholic bishops by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who oversees matters of faith and doctrine for the Vatican. And this is a letter on the fact that many, many Catholics are taking to Eastern meditation techniques. Right? So he says that, well, whatever's valid in these traditions, he said, we can take and use. He says, that's all right. But he warns them against practicing those methods that involve impersonal conceptions of God. Ratzinger was highly critical of Christians who abandoned the idea of a personal loving God, quote, in favor of immersion in the indeterminate abyss of divinity. That word abyss, by the way, comes from Christians. He also spoke against those who, quote, place that absolute without image or concepts, which is proper to Buddhist theory, on the same level as the majesty of God. So here's somebody who's trying to defend the orthodoxy of the majesty of God against the impersonal tradition. But as we've seen, these people have been, making compromise and kind of under the table playing footsie with Mayavad philosophy now for a long, long time. So this is on the other side. You know, what's happened is that the church is becoming undermined more and more completely as it comes from the East. Or you see Tillich as a Mayavadi. He's trying to somehow or other keep everybody Lutherans while at the same time accepting all the tenets of Mayavad philosophy one way or the other. But here's the Madhvites who are just like locked in debate, you know, in India. You know, two lakh rupees, you know, offering prizes with these Mayavadis and are not doing anything about it. The fact that it's spreading all over the world or anything like that. So that's the situation. You know. So what we're going to see in the world today, I think, is as I see it, there's about three different forces loose, all of which are increasing. And the three of them are more or less in opposition to each other. One of them is just impersonal Mayavad philosophy, which is starting to getting recruits from the far edge of science. In some ways, the New Age movement, the Greens, the counterculture, is opposed to much of science. But at the same time, as we see, they're also when the far left of science is joining up with these people, Tao of physics and all the stuff like that. So anyway, that's one thing. Mayavad philosophy is on the increase everywhere. The second thing is secular humanism is on the increase. These are the people who bear the banner for rigid science and that style of the Enlightenment vision, secular humanism. There's a secular humanist institute in the United States who has a team of people to systematically go around and debunk New Age claims. You know, one after another. They don't like all this mysticism, channeling, you know, anything mystical, supernormal, ESP, all that stuff they want to throw out. You know, any of that.
What's that one?
I forgot what it's called. They publish Prometheus books, and they have a magazine called The Humanist. The big guy is Paul Kurtz. I debated him on a radio show, actually. He's a professor at State University of New York at Buffalo. Oh, it's a whole organization. And they have this musician called the Amazing Randy, you know, who goes around showing that people like Uri Geller, you know, and people with psychic powers are fakes. You know, anyway. So that's one battle that's going. So there's secular humanism. Those people are really, you know, militant secular humanism. Then you have the Mayavadis. And the third thing that's growing and increasing is Christian and Islamic fundamentalism. That's becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. Not in Vancouver. It is in the United States, for example. The born again Christian movement has become a big thing.
They turn on the TV.
I mean, they've been dealt a blow, you know, by Jim Baker and what's that character? Not Oral Roberts. Swagger, Jimmy Swagger, you know. Or Roberts, but yeah, he didn't get caught with his pants down in a motel, you know. But like Swaggart did, yeah. Oh yeah. They had the lady herself on television talking about, you know, anyway, it was quite something, Swaggart. This prostitute started telling stories on Swaggart, you know, who was like the guy who was attacking all the other characters really heavy, you know. So she sells her story to Playboy magazine, you know. And that other one that brought down Jim Baker, Jessica Hahn, she also was in Playboy magazine, you know. Because Playboy, you know, magazine does have a philosophy, which is secular humanism, you know. So they're attacking these guys. The secular humanists are attacking on both ends. Anyway, it's, you know. But the biggest thing is this resurgence of Christian fundamentalism. I'll tell you where else Christian fundamentalism is growing. Especially in the form of Pentecostal religion in South America, wiping out the Catholic Church in South America. And we all know about the resurgence of Islamic fundamentalism. This is a response to modernity in the modern world and to secular humanism, you know, just back to the Bible, back to the basics and things like that. They're also, you know, we know about them too, the Christians, because we get a lot of curriculum from them for our schools, because they're the ones that have pushed alternative schools and homeschooling, because they don't want their kids going to normal schools, government-run schools in America. So they've really gone crazy developing homeschooling stuff. So there's even devotees end up at these big, long conferences that they have. Yeah. Urmila goes and from Detroit like that is very interesting. So anyway, that's another big force. And I can't predict exactly the outcome of all of this stuff. But I can see that none of them have really the key to the future. I think science is going to discredit itself, as it already is, because of when you hit what people are reacting against technology and the things that it's done. And all you're going to have to do is have a few nuclear power plants blow up or an atomic war somewhere, and then scientists will really be a dirty word. You know, it's in the cards that I think that the bankruptcy of science is there, and when there's some kind of really bigger, the big disaster that hasn't, you know, bigger than Chernobyl, you have a few of these things, a string of these things, then more and more science is going to have a hard time holding its own. Anyway, against these three forces, there's ourselves. We have a whole other angle on things, huh? Devotional service, bhakti yoga. And it's going to be very, very interesting what happens. But these are the conditions under which we can actually preach. So one of the things I wanted to point out is with our position and our argument, we can take on both the... We coming in, as you saw on that paper that I gave at this conference, at least one strategy that we should have is an appeal to other religious traditions to look at the element of bhakti. As far as I can see, you know, the Islamic and Christian traditions, they really don't have any way to intellectually confront and handle Mayavad philosophy. This Cardinal Ratzinger, or whatever his name is, he can issue warnings, but there's no philosophy behind it. As just an appeal to the authority of the Bible, or an appeal to the authority of the Quran. You can burn people at the stakes and things like that, but you're not going to be able to actually deal with it philosophically. We can't. These arguments that Prabhupada has given against Mayavad philosophy, you have not seen from any other religious tradition. No one else has tackled the Mayavadis systematically and thoroughly as Srila Prabhupada has done, and filled volumes of books with this vehement arguments against them. And also, at the same time, put forward a personal conception of God that's not at all contaminated by Mayavad philosophy, the conception of Krishna. So if we can show people that this bhakti strand is there in their Christianity and Islamic, and get them to start to develop that, what will happen is they'll find within their own tradition resources to become more and more like Krishna consciousness. Because if bhakti means to engage the senses in the service of Krishna, if they accept the principles of bhakti as been analyzed by the six Goswamis, then you'll find out that how are you going to engage the senses unless the senses have proper transcendental objects? How are you going to engage the senses without deities, without prasadam, without volumes of literature describing the pastimes and glories of God? Because there's nothing else to discuss, people turn to mundane literature. Prabhupada has that wonderful purport in Bhagavatam about why because people don't have transcendental topics, therefore there's so much mundane literature, and that if we spread Srimad Bhagavatam everywhere, they'll have some transcendental topics for discussion. Because you don't find these descriptions about God and His pastimes in such an elaborate way in the Bible and in the Quran. It's not there. Some people do in those traditions find themselves able to immerse themselves completely into those traditions. They all have their scholars who are completely immersed, but for the people in general it's very, very difficult. So you don't see that. So on the one hand, I think we can deal in this way with the fundamentalist groups. You know, we can gradually try to... as far as science goes, well, that's Sariputta's job and those people. This goes hand in hand with this effort. Prabhupada put his finger on the weak point, this theory of evolution. If that goes, everything goes. The whole intellectual basis of secular humanism and modernity itself goes with the theory of evolution. I mean, the fact is, it's already finished. They just don't know it yet. It's just a question of them finding it out. It's done already.
Them as in the
liaison? Them as the people in general. It's just a question of propagation. The thing's been exposed completely. The Christian fundamentalists are also fighting the theory of evolution, but they haven't been able to do a very good job with it. And partly it's because of the alternative. You know, people think, well, if I accept the theory of evolution, then I have to come, you know, one big stupid neon Jesus save sign. And I have to accept that the world was created, you know, for... It's not very charitable, is it? That's the way I used to think, you know, when I was a kid anyway. The world was created 4,000 years ago, whatever it is, with fossils intact, and the Bible is true, and so on and so on and so forth. A lot of people are a little more sophisticated. They can't take up this kind of fundamentalism based on the Bible or the Quran. So we have to offer them some attractive alternative.
My explanation is the universe is kind of skin.
Well, that's better than theirs. Skin pores is later. We don't begin by saying. I remember that that Vyas Puja, a homage to Prabhupada one year from New Orleans Temple or something. It says, moon is farther than the sun. With this message you have come, you know. So, actually the skin pores are much more convincing than... because they have no philosophy to speak of. It's very it's meager compared with what is rich and what we accept as revelation, but it's backed with reason and logic and argument. But in their case, reason, logic, and argument don't go very far. Fundamentalist people, they have to reject thinking ultimately as dangerous. You know, it's never been our philosophy to reject thinking as dangerous, yeah?
You're saying that these fundamentalists won't probably give up their own faith, maybe they can speak out their own bhakti.
Yeah.
But as they increase, isn't one of their missions to, like, destroy
yeah.
us?
Yeah, sure, it will be. Oh, there'll be war. With these people, it has to come down to that, ultimately. You know, this thing will not be settled on the level of ideas, you understand? It never is. No, if Krishna consciousness is going to survive, you're going to have to fight sooner or later. Because, you know, they just burn everybody at the stake. That's why in the United States it's so interesting. We're getting a little off the topic. It's interesting because, you know, for our Robin George case and things like that, all our friends and allies are all these liberals who are pushing freedom of religion. They also push abortion, things like that. And the people who philosophically are closer to us, like the fundamentalists, they're against abortion, stuff like that. We can't, you know, at all join with them in any vigorous way because, you know, the first thing they do if they got into power was, you know, burn us all at the stake. When we made an effort, with Sataputta, we made an effort to work together with the Christian creationists, wrote them some letters, and they just wrote back, said, you're of the devil, you know. Can't have anything to do with you. Although now we're starting to do some work with some of their anti-abortion groups, so it's interesting. We're working both the far left and the far right to see what happens. It shows promise. And anyway, for a lot of people, the big ground of reconciliation of religion and science and everything is this Mayavad philosophy. You know, and that's what we have to knock out, that particular aspect of things. That's our mission. More and more people will become Mayavadis. That's what people do who are originally believing Muslims and believing Christians, and they finally go to the university and get a Western education and everything, and then they want to keep on, you know, trying to be Christians or Muslims or something, but not really believe it. Then they become Mayavadis. So we have to. That's our big mission, to deal with that one. And at least among these religion people, I do want to make the case that that devotional service also provides grounds for universe, you know, harmony of religions by having variety and diversity there, as I do in that paper. Although how much of that is actually transcendental and how much is mundane, I don't really want to commit myself to right now. I don't think there's a Christian rasa or an Islamic rasa or a Hindu rasa. Those aren't rasas. But there is variety, and a lot of it's legitimate. Okay, any questions about that? Those few observations I wanted to make about our position, you know, in world affairs and our mission. Yeah? Well, there's a lot of... First threat is devotees. Pogo's second famous saying, we have met the enemy and he is us. So if ISKCON becomes unified and understands what its mission is, and therefore preaches as vigorously as we can preach, we'll become a big threat to a lot of people. You know, the fundamental, like say, I can't speak for the whole world right now. The conditions are very different in different places. You know, who's prominent. But I can tell you in the United States, if we became very, very vigorous, we would face our first big challenge would be from a combination of Christians, fundamentalist Christians, allied with people like cigarette manufacturers, beef industry. That's what would happen. The beef industry would join with the fundamentalist Christians. You know. And in that case, we'd still have the New Age movement on our side. But that would be our first major threat. People like that, the beef industry, liquor industry, and the fundamentalist Christians. They're already allied. You know, the only United States has got Roy Rogers. Roy Rogers is a fundamentalist Christian, and his wife, Dale Evans, they show up on all these talk shows and they have burgers everywhere, you know. You see whose economic interest is threatened first. Those are your biggest enemies, you know. It won't come to a fight with the New Age people and the Mayavadis and things like that. There we have to preach and make them our allies. You know, that's more our, as far as I can see there. Yeah.
I was speaking to Sadhguru earlier last year, and he was telling me about how this one Canadian scientist, paleontologist, was, according to his colleagues, was murdered for his outspoken.
Oh yeah.
Publications of anomalous evidences. So, how would you categorize these people who are behind this type of?
Yeah. Well, those people, let me say, first of all, our first big enemies would be a coalition of fundamentalist Christians and meat packers with a few other people added on. Then the second enemy would be the scientific establishment and the secular humanists. That would be the next biggest one. They would be the next biggest one because they're not so organized as the Christians. No, no, they won't. Oh, murder, you mean?
Murder.
No, they'll try to pass laws. Then they'll kill you after it's legal. Or whatever. As far as murder goes among the scientists, that I don't know. But they'll really try to fight it out too. Especially if it comes to, getting enough influence that people want to start dictating what's school curriculum, what's taught in schools, what's taught in universities, and so on. I was talking yesterday, Prabhupada's idea that we have some people get PhDs and get university positions. But I know exactly what it would like to try to actually, in a university, teach Krishna consciousness as it is. They wouldn't let you do it. If you were a scholar and you didn't accept the modern historical approach to religions, in which you viewed them all mundane historical products, You wouldn't have any position teaching in a university. You'd have a very, very difficult time if you didn't actually believe that. They wouldn't let you. You'd be thrown out. You'd be, you know. You'd lose your funding. You wouldn't get tenure, you know. But if we became strong enough that it actually presented a threat, then that next group, you know, this is the saying, these secular, I already debated these guys on a radio show in Philadelphia, you know, about, I was supposed to represent vaguely the New Age movement, you know, but they're ready to take us on too, the secular humanist stuff. You should read that magazine, The Humanist, sometime. You know, one issue will just, you know, make your hair stand on end. And they're a militant wing, but they're working really hard, you know. They're disproving everybody. They also like to go and show religious people are fakes, you know. There was this guy in America named Popoff. He was an evangelical Christian, you know, and he used to heal people all the time. People would come in and he'd walk up to him in the audience, you know, and he'd say, I know you got cataracts. I know you can't see, you know. And they name their disease. Actually, the most dramatic thing is there'd be some lady standing there in a walker, you know. You having trouble with your hips, you know. Your joints are all froze up. Well, take that walker away. And he takes it and he throws it, you know. Throws it. And crutches and walkers and everything, you know, are going like crazy. And he knows all about these people's illnesses. This happens on the TV show. Well, what happens is, and he gets people out of their wheelchairs, you know. What happens is that when they come in, this is really off the subject of my Avada philosophy. where are you from? What are your problems? You know, and some little lady, she comes walking in like, let's put you in a wheelchair. Sit down, make it easy, you know. And they give you this walker to help you get down the aisle. It's steep, you know. So they set it all up. And then he's got a little microphone in his ear. And his wife is broadcasting. And she's saying things like, you see that old bitch in the front right? She's from, you know? So what this guy, the amazing Randy did, is they went into his show with a little radio tuner and tuned in onto the frequency that his wife was broadcasting. And they got a tape of the show and they got a tape of the broadcast and they spliced them together. And then they showed it on national television in America, seeing totally, you know. Wipe the guy out, except he's still going. But I mean, they discredit it. That's what they do, things like this. This guy Popoff. Shubhananda was a big fan of him. He used to show me his videos all the time. This is before it happened, before he was discredited. With his crutches flying through the air, you know. So they're out to discredit practically everything, you know. So they'll also, these secular humanist people, they'll come for us in a big way too. Yeah.
How would you summarize that presentation of how we see how Krishna consciousness can actually be a unifying force of religions?
Well, yeah. Let me just look at this again. And then I want to start in on a list of our arguments here. I think what I say is. On page 10, all along I keep talking about mentioning as we go along about start on page 9. Through non-sectarian arguments like this, I gave that whole Karmagana Bhakti argument. ISKCON seeks to help encourage and foster the development of pure bhakti in any tradition. In any tradition, that's what I'm saying. We're not, for the purpose of this paper, and it's true, actually, this is the way I feel, is that we don't, and Prabhupada says this time and again, we don't ask them that they have to join us, let them stay, you know, become better Christians, or, you know, we're not saying, just practice devotional service. Help foster, encourage and foster the development of pure bhakti in any tradition. Yet many will fear that such a fostering of bhakti is precisely the thing which will most injure the ecumenical spirit, the spirit of unity of religions. For the negative theology of Jnana has been widely promoted as the key to inter-religious harmony and even unity. I mean, harmony is one thing, unity is going even further, right? While bhakti, with its conceptually specific object of devotion, is often held responsible for sectarian exclusivity and hostility. The claim on behalf of negative theology has perhaps been most strongly advanced by the proponents of Advaita Vedanta, often still presented as normative Hinduism. So that's always their argument. This is the key to unity among religions. You come to this platform. That was Vivekananda's big thing at the World Parliament of Religions in 1998, right? But we should consider that Advaita Vedanta solves the problem of religious pluralism and diversity by the expedient of wiping it out of the ontology. It doesn't exist. Nothing exists. It's all unreal. So it says that and I just quote Shankaracharya. Modern advocates of this position tend to combine a Shankarite metaphysics, that is, of everything is an illusion, with recent types of social and cultural relativism, leading them to indiscriminately to accept practically all forms of religious life as equally valid. It's all an illusion. Pick your illusion. Follow it. Doesn't matter what you do. For what reason is there to discriminate invidiously among illusions? And one illusion is as good as another. Right? Everything is embraced with open arms, precisely because everything is ultimately rejected right across the board. So that's their position. Unlike Jnana, bhakti does not devalorize, that is, devalue, individuality, diversity, and relativity as such. Indeed, they are found here in this world because they exist in the origin. These are all arguments we've gone over already, right? For bhakti, God, the individual souls, and the relations between God and the souls are eternal, irreducibly, and ultimately real. God sustains ongoing, ever-developing, loving relationships with innumerable souls, and in those various relationships, he discloses himself in different ways according to the nature of the relationship. As they surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. The as in this verse refers not just to differences in degree of surrender and revelation, but also to differences in kind. This is what Prabhupada says in the purport to that in the Gita. In other words, diversity and relativity in religion is not necessarily due to accidental material conditions. It comes from transcendence itself. So then I'm making my case here. You follow this? Clear?
The difference is because of the differences.
Because the differences of relationship, because we're individuals. So God reveals himself in different ways according to our approach to him. Then I have a paragraph about personhood is a social condition. It's made of relationships. Anyway, so in this way, the personalistic theology of bhakti recognizes positive spiritual value in religious diversity. To affirm genuine religious experiences wherever they do occur, it is hardly necessary to supersede devotion with speculation and a personal with an impersonal absolute. You don't have to do that to recognize real religion. Because, you know, usually the idea is that people who are worshippers of a personal God, we're right, everybody else is wrong. We have the truth, you're all idolaters, or whatever. You know, say, no, you don't have to do that. We need not propagate, this is my favorite sentence here, we need not propagate ontologies of emptiness to be liberal, broad-minded, and tolerant. If the sectarian intolerance of some devotional communities is actually a consequence of their personalism, then it is owing to too little rather than to too much of it. Because if they really understood what it meant that God is a person, they could understand that he has lots of relationships with lots of different people in lots of different ways. ISKCON thus offers a vision of interreligious unity and harmony on the platform of bhakti. Anyway, that's the. And then I go on, what about these traditions that have jnana at the top, like Buddhist traditions? And I say, well, all we can say is at least we recognize that they also have valid experiences and that the impersonal aspect of God is there. We don't say that it's unreal. Whereas those people, on the other hand, say that bhakti is a total illusion. So we give them more credit to them than they give to us. So anyway, that's the case.
It's a nice statement also that the only basis for trying to defeat them is when they used to be so hostile.
Yeah, that's right. Otherwise, they can go ahead and be targeted at the impersonal. But if in the process they start saying, you know, God is Maya, God is unreal, then we have to take exception. Yeah, that's right. Yeah?
So we were speaking about what would happen if the fundamentalists came in power. They would be very intolerant of us.
Yeah.
So if we came in power, do you think that we would actually be able to tolerate religious diversity?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it depends. It depends on who the brahminical advisors are of the person in power. But Prabhupada never told Christians not to be Christians. He just said they should stop eating meat.
That's a big one.
Yeah, it is a big one, but there's nothing in their Bible that says they have to.
Yes,
and he said, even if they want to eat meat, just wait till the cow dies and then come and take it. You can have it when it dies. Of course, you know what this turns Christians into. The kind of people in India who go and haul off the bodies of cows and make leather out of them and everything, like very low class people. Yeah, well. Yeah, I don't accept the authority of the Bible either. There's all kinds of people like that who do teach that and are of the devil too. Mayavadis, for example. So it doesn't say that everybody who teaches that is of the devil, does it? Anyway, we believe in marriage. Just like St. Paul says, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, but it is better to marry than to burn. That's our philosophy too. Burn, yeah, burn in the fires of lust. Okay, any other questions about this little discussion here? So anyway, we as far as I can see, among these different groups of the Mayavadis and the fundamentalists and the secular humanists, those are the ones that are all on the increase. And all three of them have to be tackled by us. And defeating Mayavad philosophy is crucial in this regard, especially after the secular humanists begin to fade. So I wanted to start now with our remaining time. I have outlined about 11 different kind of arguments that I wanted to start surveying with you. This is retrospective on our class. And the first one I want to mention that you should be familiar with is the argument against the speculative process of negation. That's Ishopanishad 12 purport. And another place the same argument occurs is Bhagavatam 2.9.32 in the purport. Same argument is there. In fact, I brought it. This is the beginning of the just before the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says, the Lord discloses the transcendental nature of His existence. The mundane wranglers make mundane conceptions of the form of the Lord. It is said in the revealed scriptures that the Lord has no mundane form. Therefore, persons with a poor fund of knowledge conclude that He must be formless. Why? Because all form means material form. I said that assumption is there. They cannot distinguish between mundane form and the spiritual form. According to them, Without a mundane form, one must be formless. This conclusion is also mundane, because formlessness is the opposite conception of form. Same argument. Negation of the mundane conception does not establish a transcendental fact. Well, here again, Prabhupada uses the same argument that we went through already at some length. So that's the first one, huh? This argument against the process of speculative negation, we'll call it a process. And especially on that negation, that it just is—it's also relative, it's also mundane. It doesn't secure a transcendental fact. And to me, this is one of the most powerful arguments, because if you follow it out all the way, you can use it to establish that karma, jnana, bhakti typology. Then a second argument, which is a corollary to this one, really, or is another build-up of this one, is this argument against the rejection of the positive. Was it against? So, this is the argument that the reason they reject positive concepts is they think that they will have material limitations. In other words, when they think of God having a body, they think it must be a material body, therefore they reject. Especially, you can tie this in with an argument that we have such bad experience here in the material world. We have a bad experience of a body. We have bad experiences of relationships. We have bad experiences of persons. Therefore, we think perfection must be free from relationships, persons, bodies, and so on. It's due to our bad experience. This body decays, this body rots. You have to bathe it and put all kinds of unguents and perfumes on it to keep it from stinking, you know. So therefore, God doesn't have a body. But we say, well, who says a body has to be like that? Full of pipes and pumps and tubes and so on. And in this connection, it's a good idea to explain to people what a spiritual body is. That it's not a machine. That every part, every sense can perform the function of all the other senses. So that's unlike a material body, yet it's a body, it's a form. Prabhupada gives the example, and I mentioned them before, there's the example of sweet rice. If you come to the temple and you have sweet rice and sand mixed up in it, then if somebody offers you good sweet rice, you'll still reject. And he also gives the example of being sick, where all activities are painful. So when the doctor tells you you're going to get well and you'll do all these activities, you say, oh no, I don't want to eat. Did I tell you the story about the boatman on the canal? From Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati? With the mattresses? Right. That's another good story in this regard. So this specifically counters the argument that we impose our ideas on the Supreme. Say that when you say God is a person, you're imposing our ideas on the Supreme. Now we say, no, you're opposing your ideas. You think that if he were a person, or say if he had a body, he would have a body like ours, then you reject the idea of a body. So you're imposing the material idea of a body on God and then rejecting it. We're not imposing a material idea. You're doing that and then rejecting. So is that argument clear?
We're not imposing a material
No, we're saying spiritual body. But you say God has no body because you imagine. So the argument is, as Prabhupada said, just where is it written that form means material form, name means material name? You have a material conception of these things. Then you say, if God had form, it must be material form. Who says? This is that avishuddha buddha. Your intelligence is rooted in the material world. You can't imagine. All you can imagine is negation. But that's also material. We say spiritual form. We say spiritual body. And so on. Spiritual qualities, spiritual activities. They don't have the limitation. Relationships. I reject relationships. People's dealings, sexual relationships in this world are very nasty business. So they say God has no conjugal relationship. Again, the same thing that you must imagine is going to be like my dealings. So therefore he has no girlfriend. No. These are the perverted reflections, and you're carrying over the perverted nature and then denying them of God. So that's you're imposing your ideas on God and then rejecting. That's like the boatman thinking that when he's rich, he's going to have to still pull the barge. You understand? This is a great argument. I've never had anybody actually ever come back with anything convincing and retort to it. Yeah. They usually sit there in stunned silence, you know. One thing is about Mayavadis, they think that everybody has their... They've never heard any arguments against their position, you know. Except somebody saying, well, the Bible says, you know, that's all they've ever heard. Okay, one more for today. This is an argument against, these are all against the denial of desire and activity. That is to say, of life. This is another argument that Prabhupada uses. They say that there's no activity and desire in the Supreme. And we say, yes, there are, because these are symptoms of spirit. Activity and desire. These are actually symptoms. Because for there to be activity, there must be desire. Right? There has to be an impetus or a motive. So first there's an impulse of the will, and then there has to be activity. So these two things go together. That's life. Matter is dead, inert, and lifeless, and it's because of the spiritual touch that there's activity. That the material world is a confluence, the flowing together of two energies of Krishna. This is our philosophy, the material energy and the spiritual energy. And it takes the spiritual touch for things to happen. For example, you can have an empty yard and it can be full of bricks and mortar and boards and everything. But until the living being comes, there's no house gets built. It requires the spiritual touch. A car sits there, it doesn't move. Only when a living person gets in and cranks it up does it go. Huh? It takes life. This body requires the spiritual touch to work and to function. As soon as the spirit leaves, it becomes lifeless and inert. So we see that actually activity and desire are properties of spirit. So how in spiritual life, free from the tinge of matter, will there be no desire and activities? If here we see that desire and activities is due to the presence of spirit here in this material world, when spirit's in its own element and free from the limitations of matter, why will there suddenly be no activities and no desires? Now you think desires means impure desires. But again, this is back to the previous argument, that desires are inherently nasty things. No, that's just your experience in the material world. We want to have purified desires, purified activities. You link those two arguments together. So this is another argument Prabhupada gives. That is the nature of spirit to be active. Whenever there's spirit, activity takes place. So how is spiritual life inactive? Okay, let me just say one thing about the nature of arguments. I started to bring it up yesterday. An argument that you give anybody, just takes a rigorous form of argument, a proof, you know? Take a proof. Here's a proof, you know? All men are mortal. It's a rigorous deductive argument. X is a man, therefore, that's how you write therefore in logic, X is mortal, right? All men are mortal, Bhaktajan is a man, therefore Bhaktajan is mortal. That is a valid argument form. And what a valid argument means is that if the premises are true, then it's sure and certain that the conclusion is true. Now say Bhaktajan doesn't like this argument. Even though it's a completely valid argument, it's a proof. He always has the option of denying one or other, at least one of the premises. He can say, all men aren't mortal. I haven't seen all men. Have you seen all men? No, we don't know. That's just a speculation. I could be the exception. Right? He could do this. Or he said, it's an illusion that I'm a man, actually. I'm a superior being from a higher plane. I shan't die. That's the other thing. So anytime you give an argument, the thing is, somebody can always choose to attack your premises. You know? So what an argument does is it establishes the price you have to pay for denying the conclusion. You can always choose to deny one of the premises.